Today's program is brought to you by Happy Chef Uniforms, the perfect style, whatever your recipe. Visit happychef.com to order your free 2018 catalog.
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I've been with the station for over 8 years, 350 shows, and it is the most consistent thing in my life. Every Tuesday at 3, I know to be here in studio, but I also get the privilege of meeting such amazing people, artists, artisans within the industry. I get to learn a new factoid, a new way of life from these wonderful people. And I hope you do too by listening and that you donate to our summer drive. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and click on the beating heart. And we'd even appreciate monthly recurring donations to any show on the network you could designate to the Food Scene, the Speakeasy, and that many more.
Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's theme is youth. We'll have a report on how migrant children separated from their families at the U.S. border are being housed and fed.
Right now, what we're very worried about is just the influx of kids created by this zero tolerance policy.
We'll also look into a program that's ensuring free summer meals for kids are only a text message away.
Summer is the hungriest time of year for a kid who may not have that safety net of school meals.
We discover a new home economics curriculum.
I'm not trying to raise a generation of chefs. I'm trying to raise a generation of nourishers who can nourish themselves.
And we meet a teen chef who's talked his way into several of New York's top kitchens.
I never try and be, like, annoying about it, but I really want to get my foot in the door.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's a kind of cloudy Sunday here in Brooklyn, and vive la France, they just won the World Cup, so we're not talking about French food, unfortunately, today, but we are going to be talking about a book that I am so excited about. I actually got to see this author do a reading a few weeks ago when this book just came out. It's a novel, and you know, it's really fun to talk about food-focused novels on this show, which whenever I do see them, they tend to be really, really good. I mean, food is a great... I don't want to talk to this author more about that, but, you know, they tend to be just really fun reads, and this one is a very exciting debut. It's been called a sizzling debut novel by a strikingly new literary talent. It has been featured in Best of the Season list of the Wall Street Journal, Cosmopolitan, Time, The Millions, Bitch Media, BuzzFeed, and BookBub. And so the author I'm chatting with right now is a rising star fiction writer. Her name is Lillian Lee. Hi, Lillian.
Hi, Kathy. How are you today?
Good, good. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you, and it's my pleasure.
So you're sort of a young guns here. You got your BA from Princeton and then your MFA from the University of Michigan, which is where you still live, right?
Yeah, in Ann Arbor.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And you've gotten some awards here along the way, but this is your first, you know, this is your debut novel. And
It's my baby.
It's a baby. I understand. I think I read somewhere that it started as your master's thesis.
It did, yes. I basically started this novel my first semester at Michigan and finished it and sold it right at the end of my third fellowship year. So it's really perfect timing, and I feel like timing is never going to be that great again. Mm. But it was basically just a 3 years all in Ann Arbor wrote this novel.
Mm. Why is that perfect timing? Like, just because it's you just got fresh out of school? You're like going gangbusters, or do you mean it's like
of, it's perfect timing in mm-hmm. that I basically got to write a novel in a kind of incubator space, and so mm-hmm. I was never really writing it completely alone in the wilderness. Mm. I had you know, my teachers, I had my classmates, and I had just sort of that school structure that basically told me, here, this is your priority. You're allowed to do this. You better do this. And mm-hmm. so that got rid of a lot of maybe the insecurities and doubts and other priorities that might have otherwise made this sort of journey much lonelier and much more, you know, terrifying. And so it was just really perfect timing that, you know, I got it, you know, finished and out into the world before I had to be out in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful because yeah. I'm kind of a scaredy cat.
well
so it's
done.
It's kind of nice to do it with, you know, like training wheels a little bit.
Yeah. Well, what about the other context of the subject matter and also yourself as an Asian American writer? Do you think there's something right about this cultural moment to be talking about Chinese food or, I don't know, to be an Asian American fiction writer?
I think that, you know, for whatever reason, there is, you know, so many Asian American writers who are coming out with books and, you know, really making a name for themselves, Celeste Ng, Kevin Kwan, you know, Elaine Castillo, and it's, you know, I don't really know why the time is now, because maybe what it's been is that the time has, there's always been Asian American writers, authors trying to publish, and maybe now the publishing world is finally ready for, you know, the rush that has kind of always been there. So I think it's maybe more just that the general public is ready rather than that the authors have been, you know, finding this moment. But in terms of, you know, what the book is about, it's, you know, essentially number one Chinese restaurant takes place in a, you know, Peking duck house outside D.C. And it looks at the lives of the people who own the restaurant, the Han family, as well as their longtime employees. And, you know, what happens when one day a tragedy befalls this restaurant and they no longer have the structure that's been imposing meaning and order in their lives for basically three decades. And so I think, you know, your question about whether or not this is a time for, you know, interest in Chinese food, I'm not sure that, you know, necessarily anybody, at least like from the reactions that I've gotten, it's not like people are like, oh, like now has been the time for a Chinese restaurant novel. It's more just like, whoa, like I can't believe there hasn't yet been a novel written about a Chinese restaurant. And so I've actually been trying to figure out why that is because, you know, every time I bring up that that is what the restaurant is about, the interest is always very high. Or maybe rather, what I mean to say is that the curiosity is very high.
Okay. Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure why that. You know what? Maybe the number one theory that I do have is that, you know, the Chinese restaurant and the people who work in a Chinese restaurant have always occupied a really foreign space and othered space in America, even though, you know, they're kind of everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, you know, feeling of foreignness, that curiosity has always been there. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this thing? What is this place? What is this food that is in all of our kind of daily lives, in our culture, our American culture, that we don't really know? And in some ways, that distance is also maybe why the subject has never necessarily been written about as widely, is because, you know, it's, you know, not ours. It's, you know, a thing that we don't understand. But if somebody does, you know, take the time to write about a Chinese restaurant or write about the people who work in a Chinese restaurant, that distance is always what also creates the kind of high interest, because, you know, they're kind of, they've always been maybe, we've always been maybe peeking at the Chinese restaurant, wondering what place it has in the American culture. And now that, you know, I've tried to tackle that question, that the curiosity gets to kind of come out and be visible, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, and I love how your characters are multi-generational. They're back at the house, front of the house, advisors, all this, you know, very, very diverse cast of characters here. And I was just thinking, in food writing, we tend to glorify the chef or something like that. And we don't really hear too much about that whole kind of family going on inside a restaurant. But while this is a work of fiction, I understand this is based on a real place, and you work there? The Peking Duck House? Okay. No?
I did work in a Chinese restaurant that was, you know, also served Peking duck the summer before I went to grad school, so essentially the summer before I wrote the novel. But I would say that, you know, it was not so much that restaurant that, you know, made me decide that I wanted to write the novel, but rather, you know, my treatment as a Chinese waitress in a Chinese restaurant that made me want to write a novel. So in that sense, you know, the restaurant, the Beijing Duck House, which is the fictional restaurant in the book, is not, you know, based off of any existing restaurant.
Got it. Okay.
But yeah, certainly like all of the emotions and I think all of the sort of questions that are being asked are the same things that I felt and were wondering during my very brief stint as a waitress. Mm-hmm.
So tell me more about how you were treated as a waitress that really opened your eyes to this storyline or
Yeah,
ideas.
Absolutely. So, you know, with this specific restaurant, you know, it was basically you worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. You worked both, you know, lunch and dinner shifts, which, you know, I don't really know exactly, you know, why that was allowed, but it was, you know, I had never worked in a restaurant before, so I assumed that was normal. So basically, I was spending my entire, you know, week in this space. And after the first week, I realized that, you know, I'd kind of forgotten how to have a conversation. And in fact, I had gotten so hungry for conversations that I would just kind of enjoy the sound of people talking. I wouldn't necessarily register what the customers were saying, but just, you know, I would kind of linger and be like, oh, almost nostalgic for that kind of connection and that ability to have another person look me in the face and kind of see me. And I think it took, you know, a couple more weeks for me to really be able to articulate why I was just feeling so lonely every single day. And, you know, I think that have you worked in restaurants before?
I have.
So I feel like part of what makes it bearable is that you have, the, you know, the other waiters and waitresses and staff to kind of like talk to you and complain, you know, with to get through kind of the physical and emotional labor that you have to do. And because, you know, I was working with, you know, coworkers who Chinese was, you know, their first language and English is mine. We weren't quite able to communicate quite as deeply. And so that while they were supportive and they were very kind to me, I didn't necessarily have that outlet that they had to really be able to, you know, I think have their kind of personhood and humanity given back to them by their coworkers.
Yeah. It's very
and so
intimate.
It was really that kind of time where I was just like, oh man, like, you know, you really need this kind of support network in this restaurant to be able to get through and to feel like a person again. But at the same time, you know, that still is chipping away at, you know, your understanding of yourself.
Wow, that's such a, you had an intense, you know, experience. And, but yet this is, this is, I mean, somewhat normal, right? So, I mean, do you see this as a referendum on working in restaurants today, or maybe just a celebration of just how intimately entwined you are when that happens and your coworkers are like family and I don't know, that some of that, you know, really comes through in your characters when, for instance, Pat and Annie are talking and sort of first flirting, I guess. They're talking about how their parents are, their lives like revolve around this restaurant. They exist in this restaurant. And it's just it's a thing. Do you think that's it's a good thing or a bad thing or just?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as is often the case, it's definitely both. And it is a question of almost like chicken and the egg, you know, which is the question of, like, is it worth it because you get these really strong, intense, kind of, like, out of, you know, any sort of normal relationship, you get to build these relationships with the people that you work with. At the same time, you end up neglecting, right, the very people who generally you were supposed to be building those relationships with, your family, your spouse, you know, your outside friends. And so I think, you know, what I've been, you know, thinking about when I was writing this novel and still today is, you know, what you know, human thing it is not to only want to live but to make a life. And so that even if you're in a setting where it's, you know, not necessarily where you'd like to be, you're not necessarily having the time of your life, you know, there's a lot of struggle, that even so, it is just such human nature to not just, like, make the best of it, but to adapt in a way where that sort of new environment becomes the most comfortable environment. And, you know, like, that is such a resilient and kind of amazing and magical transformation that happens. And at the same time, you know, why do we have to have that transformation happen? You know, in the end, it doesn't quite match up to the, you know, outside life, the life outside the restaurant that they, these characters might have been able to have. It's not exactly a perfect copy. It's its own thing. And so, you know, the question is, like, this, it's precious what mm-hmm. has been built inside the restaurant, but, you know, it would have also been precious the lives that, you know, these characters would have been able to lead yeah. outside the restaurant.
Wow, the way you explain it now, it's like, yeah, how come there hasn't been a book about a Chinese restaurant before? Let's talk a lot more about this book and some of your favorite Chinese food, of course.
Of course.
Right after a quick little commercial interlude.
Maybe you're looking for a coat for yourself, or you want a bold look for your staff. You might even need a new style for your restaurant, whether it's modern, industrial, or farm-to-table. Whatever you're looking for, Happy Chef has got you covered. Their wide variety of chef apparel and products are perfect for teams of all sizes and styles. And with the industry's easiest custom embroidery, you can add your logo, name, or fun artwork to many of their other products in minutes. Here's what you do. Visit happychef.com and choose from their incredible selection. With only a couple clicks, you can customize many of their products to personalize your look. Right now, they're even offering free custom logo setup on all orders over $150, a $95 value totally free. Visit happychef.com now to order your free 2018 catalog featuring new styles and incredible comfort. Happy Chef, the perfect style, whatever your recipe.
All right, we're back chatting more with Lillian Lee. She's the author of The Number One Chinese Restaurant, which is a wonderful fictional novel about family, application, competition, betrayal, love, and Chinese food. So we're chatting with her about this book, and how else can I describe it? I mean, how have, like, I'm curious from your perspective, you know, how you felt along the way about how this book has been pitched and marketed. Was there anything that you know, you felt was you really liked or didn't like so far in this journey of publishing your first book?
I think that, you know, I feel very, very lucky about, you know, the publisher that I work with, Henry Holt, the editor that I work with, my agent who I have, you know, the cover that I got, the marketing that I've gotten. And at the same time, that feeling of extreme luck is something that kind of turns my stomach because, you know, I shouldn't have to feel this lucky to get sensitive treatment, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, after I had just sold the book, I was talking to an MFA classmate, and she, you know, said, "Oh, like, are you worried about, you know, are you worried about the font problem?" And I immediately knew what she meant.
Yeah.
You know, she meant that kind of like Chinese restaurant classic stereotypical font. And at the same time, like, I hadn't actually thought about that yet. But I think that moment, like, crystallized for me this almost sort of like bizarro world universe where I might be stuck with a, you know, a book, a cover that had all of the, you know, trappings of what we stereotypically think of Chinese restaurants being. And so this entire time that I've been kind of like going through this wonderful publication journey, you know, I'm also kind of thinking of that parallel journey where everything that I feel very lucky about was not given to me.
Yeah.
And what that, how monstrous that would have been.
Yeah. How about the response so far? Are you surprised? Are you excited?
Yeah, I've been really, really gratified by the response, especially from, you know, the Asian American readers and audience that, you know, I've, you know, been very luckily able to talk to either in person or through email or on, you know, social media. you know, that was really the reader that I had in mind, because, you know, I also write generally just for myself and for, you know, therefore people with my cultural background and references. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to feel like that kind of specificity translated and, you know, people who I grew up with and, you know, that were also Chinese or Asian American really resonated with them. And it's been interesting also to see, you know, readers then who aren't from, you know, Asian American backgrounds, their response, because I think, you know, at least the way that I have framed it as a writer is that, you know, to write a specific experience is to exclude people from that experience, right? To really write for a specific person, you end up not writing for a swath of other people. And so even the reviews or, like, the responses that are, you know, like, I didn't quite get it, or I felt a little bit excluded, or that's not quite what I was hoping for, from you know, audiences that or readers that aren't Asian, it, in some ways that is also a sign that I've done something right. and I also just think that's healthy thinking as a writer.
That's good, yeah. You're very lucky, you know. You should be very lucky. I hope you don't have to hear that too much in your journey here. I know you've just sort of begun, and you've done a lot of tours, actually, speaking about this book. So you must have been, you know, collecting a lot of responses so far. I'm just curious, because it sounds like you've been wanting to be a writer for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Did you ever imagine that your first debut novel would be about or set in a Chinese restaurant?
I think that...
Like, why that? Like, why food?
Absolutely. I think that I'm definitely surprised. I think, like, the younger version of myself would be. At the same time, you know, I think that I have always wanted to write about Chinese-Americans and Chinese-American communities.
Yeah.
And the Chinese restaurant setting is really perfect in that, you know, you get to just assume as the reader that every person who shows up on the page is going to be Chinese or Chinese American, and not, you know, sort of what we tend to default to, which is, you know, if a character shows up and we don't hear what their race is, we assume white, at least, you know, American readers do, and I do as well. And so in some ways, I think this younger version of myself would be very kind of like happy about how I've managed to find this setting that is not only so thematically rich and so character driven, but also gives me that license to write about my characters without having to identify them by race first. So you get to know them by their race, but also just by all the other parts of their identity and what makes them human. I think that's probably what my younger reaction would be.
And it's interesting, you don't, you know, some of these very distinctive sort of references to, I guess, being a Chinese American are the way that you address people. There's sometimes Ajak or Ame is used, and instead sometimes they're just called Jack or May. So, and you don't stop the narrative to explain that. So I think that's really interesting. It is a sort of like assumed sort of, you know, and maybe if you're reading along and you don't understand why that in term is added to a name, then maybe you just have an idea of it. What do you take from that for people who haven't heard May and before, so forth before?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in some ways, because Chinese is already so, I think, phonetically interested, right, that a lot of what... you know, the Chinese words tend to be onomatopoeia and, in fact, evoke maybe the feeling or the sense that the word actually means, which is what I love so much about, you know, my language. That kind of awe, I'll do the explaining now. It's basically a way to kind of, you know, give a brotherly or a sisterly sense to a person, right? It's just kind of a little like a nickname to be like, hey, we're close. I like you. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, like, ah, Jack, you know, that kind of awe, that lilt to it already maybe, for me at least, evokes that sense of closeness. And that sense of familiarity. And so I guess what I, you know, am hoping with is that For the readers who don't get the understanding of what that kind of moniker means, that it's still language-wise evoking that feeling that it's supposed to evoke. So, you know, they'll be feeling something and maybe not knowing why is my sort of like great desire.
Cool. But that's what I would think that would come through too in reading this book. So that's cool. Okay. So there isn't like, you know, food doesn't play a huge role, I have to say, you know, in this book. It's mostly about the human characters. It is obviously an everyday part of the scenery in this book. Are you a foodie? Does writing about, you know, the duck and the, I don't know, lamb chops and fried rice cooking, like, just excite you to some extent?
It does. I mean, I feel like there's a word that isn't quite foodie, but it basically just means someone who just really loves to eat, and doesn't matter, like, what they're eating, but I am that person. And so as long as there's, like, just something that I can, like, kind of chew on, I'm, like, pretty happy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, when I was first writing the book, I had, you know, I was very much in the character Jimmy's head. So he's the younger son who has inherited this duck house and is embarrassed, honestly, by the food. And because I was so in his head, you know, when I was writing about those lamb chops, originally in the draft, they were a greasy pile. They were like, there was nothing tasty or like evocative about them. And in fact, all of the food that was described in those terms.
Got it.
It was actually like stomach turning.
So through his lens, yeah.
And luckily, you know, I had my editor pull me aside, and she was like, you know, like, do you like American Chinese food? And honestly, I do. I think it's really tasty. And she's like, it is tasty. Like, it's not necessarily always good for you or, like, made super well, but it's always delicious.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's, you know, something that you have to bring through. And I realized that was, you know, something that was also missing from, Jimmy's perspective, which is that, yes, maybe this food doesn't get the kind of respect that he wants, the kind of dignity that he wants, but it's delicious, and, you know, it fills people up, and that's really how it should be described as well, you know, with the full perspective of what American Chinese food is, which is, you know, in the end, delicious, and I love it.
Mm-hmm. That is really interesting. There's so many ways to describe food that can evoke, you know, what a character is thinking. So I love hearing about that. Did you have to do any research aside from working at a restaurant for a bit to write about how the cooks are, you know, using the woks and anything like that? Or
so because I could sort of see how the kitchen was set up in that brief time that I was working, and I could see that, like, you know, there were just huge flames that engulfed the woks. Mm-hmm. Even if I didn't know what that was, I knew that that wasn't what I thought a kitchen was supposed to look like. So, you know, thank goodness that Google exists so I could figure out those mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also very lucky to have stumbled upon this really amazing New Yorker article by Lauren Hilger's The Kitchen Network, which details essentially the sort of daily life of a Chinese cook in America, and how he sort of travels from New York to Maryland and, you know, just kind of like plugs into whatever, Chinese restaurant needs him. And so that was invaluable, I think.
Cool.
Just to read that.
That is really interesting. Yeah. So that helps inform a very real sort of picture of a Chinese restaurant today in your book.
Just the internal logic of it, I think, is really important to get on the page.
Cool. So I guess we're about out of time right now, but what do you hope people take away from this book?
So, you know, at the very start, I think, of this journey, I would say things like, oh, you know, I hope that people learn something new about Chinese waiters or think differently about Chinese waiters. And then, you know, after saying that for a while, it's like, that's not what I want.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I don't care at all if they, like,
you can answer this however you feel today. Yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of just like, I hope that you take away some, like, you think about your life differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want you to think about these Chinese waiters differently because they were always human beings. I'm not trying to prove that they were human beings. But if you weren't ever sure that they were human beings, I hope that, you know, then you take away that preconceived notion and you wonder why you thought of them as less than human.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, the sort of thing that I hope people take away is just, you know, some kind of shifted view or change in how they move through the world and how they think about other people.
Hmm. Very, very well said. turn it around on you first. I love that. Well, Lillian, I really, really enjoy this book. Wonderful
Thank
job.
You.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You so much.
And you can catch Lillian at her, you know, lillianleeauthor.com website for any, right? Is that right?
Yes, that's
okay,
correct.
Awesome. For any, you know, tours that she may, or readings that she may be doing in your city. And yeah, just check out this new book out from Henry Holt. So thanks again, Lillian.
Thank you, Kathy.
All right. Thanks to everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Never had no loving like this before.